Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway, and this edition is published in the early hours of Wednesday, the 11th of December. Our main stories. US Democrats have announced two counts of impeachment against President Trump, accusing him of abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. A former Mexican minister who oversaw the National Police for 6 years has been arrested in the US on charges of colluding with the Sinaloa drug cartel. And the latest research reveals that Greenland's ice sheet is melting 7 times faster than in the 1990s. Also in this podcast, we look back at the life of the man who transformed Moscow after the end of communism. And later,
the big so-called mega constellation operators, SpaceX and others, are talking about launching 20 to 50,000 new satellites there. So this is a really, really pressing problem.
We hear about the first official mission to remove space junk from Earth's orbit. The Democrats have announced the two impeachment charges they want to bring against President Trump. They say he abused his power in his dealings with Ukraine and he obstructed Congress. The House of Representatives will vote on whether to impeach the president in the next few days, paving the way for a trial in the Senate. The White House said the charges were false and Mr. Trump expected to be fully exonerated. Our North America editor John Sopel has this report.
On this solemn day, I recall that the first order of business for members of Congress is the solemn act to take an oath to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States.
And with those words, the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, set the stage for a dramatic announcement. Articles of impeachment had been drawn up against the 45th President of the United States. The language seemed to belong to a bygone era, as constitutional I's were dotted and T's crossed. The charge sheet was read out by the Democratic chairman of the Judiciary Committee, Jerry Nadler.
Today, in service to our duty to the Constitution and to our country, the House Committee on the Judiciary is introducing two articles of impeachment charging the President of the United States, Donald J. Trump, with committing high crimes and misdemeanors.
The first charge is that the President abused his office for personal political gain. A number of senior officials alleged in the course of the impeachment hearings that Donald Trump withheld vital military aid to Ukraine until Kiev launched a corruption investigation into the president's potential 2020 rival, Joe Biden, and a Ukrainian energy company that the former vice president's son had been a director of. The second is that the White House obstructed Congress by doing everything to thwart and block the impeachment investigation. President Trump has reacted with fury and denied any wrongdoing. If the House of Representatives votes to impeach Donald J. Trump, he'll become only the third US president to be sanctioned in this way. But there's very little chance that in the next stage, the Senate will vote to remove him from office, where such a move would require a two-thirds majority. All that, though, is for the history books. It's what happens next that matters. Will this be a grievous blow to Donald Trump winning a second term? Or will the American people see this as a political hit job against their president? The language is of upholding the Constitution. But don't be gulled. There is raw political calculation too.
John Sopel in Washington. Officials from the US, Mexico and Canada have signed a revised version of their new trade deal after more than 2 years of tough negotiations. Once it's ratified, the deal will replace the 25-year-old North American Free Trade Agreement. Here's Will Grant.
Reaching a new trade deal to replace NAFTA was a key tenet of President Trump's 2016 election platform. The US Trade Representative, Robert Lighthizer, who described the cooperation between the three countries as a miracle, said he brought with him the personal gratitude of President Trump. Inside the US, Mr. Trump also seems to have the agreement he sought with the Democrats. The House Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, confirmed that an understanding had been reached over the sticking points of environmental and labour conditions and enforcement. The deal will now go before the House and the Senate in the US for a final vote, possibly before the end of the year.
Will Grant. For his part, Mexico's President Andrés Manuel López Obrador said the deal was good for the workers of all three countries and would help with the problem of migration. 5 months after a judge in New York sentenced the Mexican drug lord Joaquin El Chapo Guzman to life in prison, a former Mexican government minister has been arrested in Dallas on drug conspiracy charges. For 6 years, Genaro García Luna was in charge of Mexico's federal police and ensuring public safety. But at the same time, he allegedly took millions of dollars in bribes from Guzman's Sinaloa cartel. Our correspondent Neda Taufik is following developments from New York.
Prosecutors are saying that essentially what Mr. García Luna did was to abuse his power to help the Sinaloa cartel, and specifically by providing safe passage for its drug shipments, by giving them sensitive law enforcement information about the investigations into the cartel, and even information about rival cartels so they could stay ahead of what they were doing. And they said all of this really was essential to helping the cartel facilitate the importation of tons of cocaine and other drugs into the United States. And they say that they have evidence from law enforcement to support this. And you mentioned there the trial of El Chapo Guzman, the former leader of the Sinaloa cartel. Well, during that trial, there was testimony by several former high-ranking members. And one of them, Ray Zambada, actually said that he personally delivered briefcases containing about $3 to $5 million to Mr. García Luna. They also point to the fact that they have financial records from Mr. García Luna, because he moved over to the United States in Florida in 2012. And those financial records show that he amassed a personal fortune, even though he was on a civil servant salary in Mexico.
And this period that we're talking about, 2006 to 2012, Mr. García Luna was a key part of the security apparatus in Mexico as the government there began its war against the drug cartels.
That's right. He was a key minister under the president at the time, Felipe Calderón. Remember, he was the first to really deploy troops, military troops, against the cartels. There was a lot of distrust within the police. And Mr. García Luna controlled the federal police from 2006 to 2012. So he was really seen as a figure who was supposed to be helping with this. And it's interesting to see in Mexico, when you talk to so many people about the cartels, they really had suspicions that they were only able to operate because they were able to have such good inside information. And so many will look at this case as more proof of their suspicions.
Neda Taufik in New York. According to polar scientists, Greenland is now losing ice 7 times faster than during the 1990s. Researchers reviewed satellite observations from the past 25 years. They say Greenland's contribution to rising sea levels is now in line with the more pessimistic projections for future climate change. Professor Andrew Shepherd from the University of Leeds led the research. He spoke to Tim Franks.
Greenland is, unfortunately for it, further away from the pole than Antarctica, so it suffers from melting in summer, and it suffers from glaciers that flow into the ocean, retreating as the ocean warms as well. So it's a two-pronged assault on the ice sheet. And that tells us something about how to expect those changes to develop in the coming decades. So it's important to be able to understand why the ice sheet is losing ice, because that gives us more confidence in predictions for the future.
Does it give us more confidence for predictions as to what's going to happen elsewhere? I mean, can we say that because it's at the worst end of predictions for Greenland, it's likely to be just as bad for a place like Antarctica, where there's even more ice?
Well, we published a similar report on Antarctica last year, and the same story was true there, unfortunately. So both ice sheets tracking the worst-case scenarios. What that means is that sea level rise will be higher than expected, but it also means that the climate models need to invent new worst-case scenarios, because we're already tracking those.
Are you able to quantify what that sea level rise is likely to be? I mean, I read in your research that sea level has already been raised by 1 centimetre by what's happened to Greenland.
Yeah, I think there's good confidence because some parts of the climate system behave quite well. I mean, it's just like an ice cube at home. If you raise the temperature of the room, it will melt more quickly. So although the sea level rise so far over the past 30 years has only been equivalent to 1 centimetre, a sevenfold increase in 30 years is something that we can't afford to happen in the next 30 years. And if that were to happen again, then in 30 years' time, Greenland would be contributing 7 times as much as it is today to sea levels rise. And then in 30 years again, another 7 times. And it starts to add up pretty quickly. But the really important number that people should hold in their minds, if they can, is that every centimetre of global sea level rise will lead to about 6 million people around the planet experiencing floods once per year in the future. And that's just because of the steady creep of sea level that pushes up the frequency of storm flooding in the rainy seasons that happen everywhere on the planet.
And that's key, isn't it? Is that people completely understandably often focus on what might happen to those small islands in the Pacific that will be inundated. But when you're talking about that level of flooding, you're talking about people who live in coastal regions around the world who will also be very predictably and very regularly severely affected.
That's correct. And we know it in the UK, actually. We have seasonal flooding every November in the UK. It happens inland because of severe rainfall, and it happens in the coastal regions because of severe storms. And in the future, that will stop people getting to work. It will stop goods getting from ports to inland cities, and it will stop farmers being able to grow on land that's close to the coastline.
And one of the big questions that's always asked when research like this comes out is whether we are too late to halt what seems to be an accelerating process.
It is true that the ice sheets are the runaway train of the climate system in that they've taken a long time to get going, and it's only recently that we've seen the step up in ice loss. But that doesn't mean that there aren't things we can do about it. The first thing that people can do is believe that this is happening. I think there's been a tendency to push it to the back of our minds and not think that it's a serious problem for our generation or even the next generation, but it is. The second thing that people can do is to put their trust in politicians who are prepared to also believe in climate change, because there are some that do and there are some that don't.
Earth Observation, Professor Andrew Shepherd. 33 people have been arrested in more than 10 countries around the world for sharing child pornography and extremely violent content on the messaging service WhatsApp. Danny Eberhard reports.
The network first came to light more than 2 years ago, after Spanish police got an email tip-off. Most of the arrests, 17, took place in Spain. Everyone arrested there is male, the youngest a boy of just 15. Some are said to have normalised the sexual abuse of children by sharing sometimes extreme images on WhatsApp. People were also detained in 10 other countries in Europe, Latin America, the Middle East and South Asia. One in Uruguay is a mother who's alleged to have abused her own daughter.
Danny Eberhard. The former mayor of Moscow, Yuri Lushkov, who presided over the transformation of the Russian capital after the end of communism, has died at the age of 83. During the 1990s, he was a major political figure and a key ally of President Boris Yeltsin. But Mr. Lushkov eventually fell out of favour and was dismissed in 2010. Our Moscow correspondent Steve Rosenberg looks back at his life.
In today's Russia, there's only one man, really, who's allowed to shine on the political stage: Vladimir Putin. But go back 20 years or so to a time when the Kremlin didn't control everything, and you'd find a number of colourful characters in positions of power. None of them, though, was more charismatic than Yuri Lushkov.
И добрым городом для всех москвичей и для всех наших гостей. Ура!
The tough-talking, crowd-rousing Mr. Lushkov was Moscow mayor for 18 years. In that time, he oversaw Moscow's transformation from the grey, crumbling capital of communism to a glitzy, modern metropolis of post-Soviet Russia. He loved big projects and rebuilt from scratch a giant cathedral Joseph Stalin had blown to pieces. He sang with pop stars, he played football, and he kept bees. He was ever so proud of his honey. But things began to get a little sticky for the mayor. There were accusations of corruption, cronyism. His wife went into the construction business and became Russia's richest woman. A coincidence, surely. He denied abuse of power. But in 2010, he was sacked by President Medvedev, who said he'd lost confidence in him. Today, President Putin described Yuri Lushkov as an outstanding figure, and the Russian Association of Beekeepers expressed its condolences.
Steve Rosenberg on Yuri Lushkov, who's died at the age of 83. And still to come on the podcast:
the laser spots one of those mysterious patches of squiggles and digits about the size of a postage stamp printed on most labels nowadays. It's a code that tells not only price, but description.
Remembering the man who revolutionized shopping by inventing the barcode. A sixth person has died in hospital in New Zealand after Monday's volcanic eruption on White Island. A further 30 people are still being treated for severe burns. 8 remain missing on the island, presumed dead. Shaima Khalil is at Whakatane Harbour, where the first evacuees were taken.
The haze and smoke from White Island's volcanic eruption still hover over the area. I can just about make it out standing here on the windy shores of Whakatane Harbour. People were brought here when they were first evacuated, but not all of them made it out. 8 bodies are still on the island, just a boat ride away from where I am, all covered in ash. After the police have confirmed time and time again that surveillance aircraft have seen no sign of life, this is very much a recovery operation, but even that hasn't been possible. Conditions are still too unstable in the area. Officials say there is a 50% chance of a smaller or a similar size eruption in the next 24 hours. Russell Clark is one of the paramedics who helped move the injured into safety. He described the scene on the island.
It was like the Chernobyl miniseries. Everything was just blanketed in ash. It's pretty overwhelming. I mean, the amount of dust, it really hits home. I can only imagine what it was like for the people that were there at the time. They had nowhere to go, an absolutely terrible experience for them. Both traumatic and emotional recovery is going to take a long time.
White Island is one of New Zealand's most active volcanoes, but also a very popular tourist destination. Mary Scully lives close to the Whakatane Harbour and has once gone on a trip to the volcano in White Island with a local guide who's also a family friend. Hayden Marshall Inman was on the island that day.
I've known Hayden since he was primary school age, going through the swimming club, soccer and all the things that kids do. He's the same age as our son. He's one of those really good guys. Yeah, so it's very sad.
Do you think there should have been more warnings to people, given the high alert? Should they have been there?
We hear that there's an alert on White Island, and if you're not going out there, of course it doesn't mean anything to you, but it could have been fine yesterday and it could have blown up next Saturday.
Unpredictable.
Yeah, it's like, when is a good time for a mountain to blow its top?
How has this affected you, what happened?
It just makes us aware of the fact that there is always danger, and it might not be that, it might be just simply going out on a boat, out into the sea or something like that, and yeah, it's a wake-up call.
Police are now investigating circumstances of the death and injuries on White Island, an active volcano that has long been a tourist attraction, but has now turned into a site of utter devastation.
Shaima Khalil reporting from New Zealand. It is exactly a year since Canadian Michael Kovrig was detained in China. He'd been accused of spying. He was held at the same time as another Canadian, Michael Spavor, just days after Canada had arrested Meng Wanzhou, a top Huawei executive and daughter of the firm's founder. Many suspect the Canadians were detained in retaliation. Mr. Kovrig was working for the International Crisis Group. Its president, Robert Malley, told our Asia-Pacific editor Michael Bristow what Mr. Kovrig was doing in China.
He was very openly, transparently going to China, speaking to Chinese officials, Chinese academics, trying to get a sense of their views about conflict around the world and what role China could play in trying to resolve or prevent them, and then writing about it. So there was nothing secret in what he was doing.
You said he interviewed officials. Is there any way at all the Chinese accusations against him that he was involved in stealing state secrets is true?
Michael was traveling to China regularly for years, openly seeing the same people, letting them know what he was doing. He was never troubled or harassed during those periods. 9 days after the Chinese CFO of the Huawei company, the Chinese company, was detained in Canada on extradition charges to the U.S., he gets picked up along with another Canadian. I don't think one has to know too much about what in fact happened to understand that this has nothing to do with what he was doing and everything to do with his citizenship and what had been happening between China, Canada, and the U.S.
Could you tell me exactly where we are in the Chinese legal process with his detention?
To be honest, there is no real legal process. He hasn't been legally charged. He is being held. He may be charged. That may happen. There's been statements by Chinese officials alleging certain things, including what you just said, that he had been involved in passing state security information to a foreign party. But none of that has been formally asserted. And so at this point, he is still in the dark as to why he's being detained, and he's still in the dark about when he'll be released.
Could you tell me something about the conditions in which he's been detained?
Michael does not have access to his family or to his lawyer in the past year. He has consular visits roughly once a month. A Canadian ambassador or somebody from the embassy sees him. You could imagine being picked up for no cause, being held without any explanation, not being told when you're going to leave, held in a cell and not having any access to either the people you love or the people who are supposed to defend you. And you could imagine what that's been like.
They're not going to release him either, unless Meng Wanzhou gets released in Canada.
Well, obviously, I think if she does get released, that would be the turning point for him. I don't know that it's a precondition. I'm hoping, again, that the point that we've been making now for a year, which is that this is not just about Canada and China. It's not just about the International Crisis Group in China. It's about all the diplomats, all the academics, all the business people who want to engage with China and who now get this chilling message. From that point of view, one would hope that China would reach the conclusion that this is disserving its interests and that if it has issues with Canada or with the United States, it has other means of expressing those issues and dealing with them than arbitrarily arresting an individual.
Robert Malley from the International Crisis Group. 2 months ago, the Norwegian Nobel Committee announced that the 2019 Peace Prize was being awarded to the Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed for reaching a peace accord with the president of neighbouring Eritrea. The citation said Mr. Abiy represented a new generation of African leaders who realised conflict must be resolved by peaceful means. But the decision has been controversial, with many saying the promised peace between the two former enemies hasn't materialised. On Tuesday, Mr. Abiy was in Oslo to formally accept the award, saying his commitment to peace came from having experienced war as a soldier.
I witnessed firsthand the ugliness of war in frontline battles. There are those who have never seen war but glorify and romanticize it. They have not seen the fear. They have not seen the fatigue. They have not seen the destruction or heartbreak, nor have they felt the mournful impotence of war after the carnage. War is the epitome of fail for all involved. I know because I have been there and back. I have seen brothers slaughtering brothers on the battlefield.
Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed. Next to the final frontier in rubbish collection. The first mission to remove space junk from orbit has been announced by the European Space Agency. But it will be no easy task. More than 500,000 pieces of rubbish are currently hurtling around the Earth at breakneck speed. Mark McCochrane is the ESA's Senior Advisor for Science and Exploration. He's been talking to Dan Damon.
We've had a number of trials done in places like the space station, effectively harpooning bits and pieces and seeing if we can actually make contact, draw them back in and prepare the ground for this new mission, which will be indeed the first to go and get a piece of hardware that was left over from a previous launch of ours. So we're cleaning up our own rubbish, grab it with four arms and then return it to the ground. So it's a fairly simple piece of equipment that we're going to grab. It's basically an adapter, a fairly smooth piece of gear. Many of the other things we'll go and get in the future are much more complicated bits of hardware. So we've got to practice the techniques before we can go in there and start really cleaning up.
So what are the techniques?
We've been trying with harpoons and nets. This one is a grabber. It has four arms. It's a fairly big piece of equipment that it's going to be getting a hold of. So the satellite itself is fairly large. It was launched in 2013. It weighs about 100 kilograms. So you might say it's a small satellite. There are much bigger things than that we need to bring down in the future. So other techniques might be applicable there. And there are much smaller things as well. You mentioned hundreds of thousands of pieces of small debris at centimeter type scale. And there, different techniques might be needed entirely.
Well, we've seen that movie, haven't we? Caused tremendous destruction and tear spacesuits and George Clooney dies and all that.
This is indeed the point, is that debris is not passive in the sense that if it doesn't come back down to Earth, there is the chance of two pieces of debris hitting each other, and then they create lots more debris. And this runaway effect, where very rapidly, over a period of even days, you might actually clear out a whole piece of orbital space. You might destroy all satellites at a certain altitude. It's called the Kessler syndrome, and gravity got that very right. And it is a pressing danger, particularly at the moment, because we're talking now about launching tens of thousands of new satellites into this low Earth orbit domain. There are a couple of thousand there at the moment, but the big so-called mega constellation operators, SpaceX and others, are talking about launching 20 to 50,000 new satellites there. So this is a really, really pressing problem.
European Space Agency advisor Mark McCochrane. One of the unsung architects of the modern world has died. George Laurer was 94. He may not be a household name, but the technology he developed is in use around the world every day. the barcode. Here's News Archive from 1975, in which a journalist attempts to explain how it works.
Ruby red laser beam is concealed inside a window in the checkout counter. The clerk pulls each item past the window, and the laser spots one of those mysterious patches of squiggles and digits about the size of a postage stamp printed on most labels nowadays. It's a code that tells not only price, but description. In a twinkling, as each item is packed, the price is flashed to the consumer and printed at the same time. A complete grocery list typed out by machine.
Simple. Well, barcodes form the basis of many things, from digital photography to ISBN numbers on books. But they've had the biggest impact on retail, as we heard from Deborah Sugg-Ryan, Professor of Design History at the University of Portsmouth here in the UK.
The barcode's first commercial uses were in American supermarkets to speed up the supermarket checkout, but also to keep a track on the inventory of products. So it meant that you no longer had to affix individual prices on labels to products. This enabled them to crack down on price swapping, which was a way of kind of shoplifting, you know, swapping the prices around on products, but also keeping track on what consumers bought as well. There was a lot of suspicion of lasers at first. We've lost that now. And I think the big change now is that we self-scan in supermarkets. So something, you know, that was invented to speed up going through the supermarket checkout, now in lots of shops, they've got rid of that checkout altogether. So we were self-scanning at the till or on a handheld device as we go through the shop. So there's an argument to say that though it kind of intensely personalizes shopping in a way of linking it to your loyalty card so shops can keep a track of you, it's also depersonalized it because it's taken away that human interaction and point of purchase. Of course, it's not just used in supermarkets, it's used on all sorts of other products like tickets, when we're posting parcels. If you go into hospital, you'll have a barcode affixed to you on your identification tag and all the drugs that you're prescribed. So it has this kind of ubiquity, which I think is hard to replace.
Professor of Design History, Deborah Sugg-Ryan. Finally, the singer in the band Roxette, Marie Fredriksson, has died at the age of 61. The Swedish star achieved global success in the 1990s with hits including The Look, Joyride and It Must Have Been Love, which featured in the film Pretty Woman. It must have been. A statement said the singer had died following a 17-year battle with cancer. Her bandmate, Per Gessler, paid tribute, saying, "You were the most wonderful friend for over 40 years. Things will never be the same." And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this edition or anything in it, send an email to globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.
By listening first, strategizing second, and collaborating constantly, MetLife Investment Management takes a client-first approach to institutional investing. With expertise in public fixed income, private capital, and real estate, we are institutional, but far from typical. Learn more at MetLife.com/institutional. That's MetLife.com/institutional.